I'm going to be relying this evening on Steve's trusty index finger, because my remote control is not working from this distance or this angle or something, so Steve's going to be hitting the space bar for various slides. And then later in the evening, hopefully, I'm putting in some DVDs for us to discuss as well. So basically, up on the screen here, I've got an outline of what I hope we're going to do in the next sort of three quarters of an hour or so. And basically, I'm going to talk through now these first three bullet points in, I hope, about half an hour. And then after that, we can perhaps have a couple of questions, and then we'll turn to some films, which we can discuss by just looking at a short clip or perhaps the trailer. I can also obviously give an intro to those of you who don't know them. And we'll, you know, hopefully be able to put some of what we talked about in the first part into practice, talking about some actual films in the second. And so just to say that I've struggled a bit as to what to say tonight, and I'm actually not going to go to the meat of my thesis. Really, I'm going to end down here where my thesis began. So I spent 4 years here doing MPhil in modern systematic theology, 2 years in DPhil, looking at the possibility of revelation through film, looking at the theologian and philosopher Paul Tillich, and looking specifically at Latin American cinema and some people who'd had profound experiences initiated by viewing particular films. But as I say, today I'm really going to do an introduction and then finish where I began, but you can obviously ask questions if you'd like to. So Steve, hopefully, I'm going to begin just as an introduction by talking about this film magazine called Little White Lies. Has anybody ever picked up a copy of that? As you can see, even quite a long time ago, I think it was $3.95 or something, so it's quite expensive. But it's a slightly kind of arty film magazine, has no Christian sort of background at all, but, you know, likes the thoughtful end of cinema, we might say. And for a while, when I was doing my DPhil, I used to write festival reports for them, basically because it got me a very nice press accreditation to go into film festivals and watch films. And at the time, they used to run a festival called DocFest here, a documentary film festival in Oxford, based actually at sort of Keble College and the cinemas around about. And if you click the next one, in this issue, you saw on the cover of the previous slide, Garcia Bernal, isn't it, the Mexican actor. Here you have a Mexican film director, Iñárritu. And basically the edition of the magazine that we just showed came out at the time of his film Babel. And at the very sort of front page of the magazine, they'd taken a couple of quotes from the interviews which they'd done with Iñárritu and with Bernal. And if you click on, Steve, this is some of what they said. So Little White Lies, obviously the editor of the magazine. What do you love about movies? Obviously a bit of a comprehension gap there, because he says about movies, and he says, yes, movies. And then Iñárritu goes on, wow, there are so many angles. What do I love about the movies? I think a way to put it is that besides the fact that I can eat popcorn without guilt, he's going deep, straight from the beginning, I think that it reminds me of and reveals to me things about the human condition that I'm not aware of until that moment. It brings me closer to the things that I should be close to, but I've forgotten. When a film touches me on that level, it reminds me of my own life, and it gives me a justification for this complex life that we're living. It puts me in touch with the source and the reason and the meaning of life. Now, given that he's gone from popcorn to the source and the reason and the meaning of life in about sort of 50 words, you have to take this kind of thing with a grain of salt, at least. But I do think that in our society, film is one of the things that touches on those big questions that I was talking about, even in the context of something like Veritas. It's one of the media that raises in people's minds and their lives some of these things of what is this all about? And so this is from the side of the filmmaker. The next slide, Steve, if that's okay, is actually an article. This is their, sort of, I don't know why they went for this bizarre style in this particular edition of the magazine, but this is an article that I had about a year after that interview in their magazine. And if you can make it out, the blue and the yellow, the title is Real Passion. Now, do you see what I did there? The Real Passion. It's a really old trick, which everybody does. But basically, it's an opportunity to talk in this magazine about the number of films that draw on Christ imagery, particularly the kind of sacrificial, redemptive death imagery of, you know, the Christian tradition and scripture. And so it's just, it's a small thing, but I think that film provides the Christian community with a particular space where we can engage with some of the big questions, with people who don't necessarily share our worldview or our priorities or our values or our faith or belief, but in a way which is quite neutral, because we're genuinely drawing on things which are in, you know, these films which the directors have deliberately put there, and we're, you know, able to talk about them from a particular perspective. So what I'm going to do now, having given that introduction as to why I think this is an interesting area, is to just skim you through, I hope fairly quickly, an overview of the way in which faith, and particularly tonight we're thinking about the Christian faith, has engaged and related to the industry or the art form or the medium of cinema and film through the 20th century. And according to legend, at least, the birth of cinema can be located and dated with quite remarkable precision. So apparently, on the evening of the 28th of December, 1895, in the Grand Café of Paris, the Lumière brothers entertained a paying audience with projections of short films they had photographed on their cinematograph machine. Steve. And this is one of the very first films that they made. It's about 50 seconds long. It has the very inventive title of Train Arriving at a Station. And basically, they had a camera set up here, and they literally filmed the arrival of a train. And the story is, and I have to say, unfortunately, I think this is apocryphal, but the story is that when they first played this film, the audience, i.e. you, ran screaming to the back of the room, because never before had they seen something like this in motion. You can imagine, obviously, the perspective of a huge steam locomotive coming towards them. So I think, in all honesty, no Genesis is quite as clear-cut as its creation myths would have us believe. And obviously, behind this event lay a whole history of kind of developments in photographic techniques, obviously primarily by Thomas Edison. Behind this lay a whole history of ways of creating moving images, the sort of magic lantern, the zoetrope, those kinds of things. But there was something unique about what the Lumière brothers did, there's no doubt about it. This was an important breakthrough, and within just a few years, this had become, you know, the sort of the economic impact of cinema was vast. There were huge audiences that were willing to pay to see these moving pictures, and Auguste Louis became very famous and very wealthy before their particular sort of realist style was overtaken by other cinematographers like Georges Méliès. But it was amazing, and, you know, I did my research, often a lot of it in Latin America, and within a few years of this, they had travelling cinemas in the most kind of dust bowl towns you can imagine in the middle of Brazil or Argentina or Mexico, showing, you know, these moving pictures, these new cinema films. And interestingly, for our topic tonight, cinema turned almost immediately to religion. So if you remember, I said that first showing is dated in December 1895. In 1896, the Horitz Passion Play was shot and screened in Paris. And this, which is not the Horitz one, this is a few years later, but this is still in the 19th, not yet the 20th century. And this is the very, very famous Passion Play of Abraham Gao, and it was filmed. And this is considered, in any book that you read of sort of film history, this is considered the first ever movie poster. And the really lovely bit is that it says down here, the crucifixion, this is an actual scene, reproduced by means of 2,554 feet of live motion picture film. So this is the early, early days, and almost immediately, religion is part of cinema. But I guess it's unsurprising if we think of what are often thought of as the six traditional arts, clearly depictions of Jesus Christ, of religious subject matter, you know, absolutely ubiquitous. it was a natural progression that they would move, you know, in this new seventh art, as it's sometimes called, to, you know, sort of religious subject matter. But very soon after beginning with the Jesus story, clever, greedy, perhaps, filmmakers decided that the religious subject matter that would make the best films were the violent and the sexually charged. So after the Passion plays, God, this guy's good. He moves on. The moved almost immediately to this as the classic sort of Cecil B. DeMille, Samson and Delilah, and Salome dancing for John the Baptist's head, David and Bathsheba. These are the subjects that people decided to make religious films on because it got people paying their ticket. And so right from very, very early on, there is a question begged about this new medium. It has this tremendous power and potential to portray religious truth, if you like, or certainly religious narratives. But at the same time, it can clearly also be used deliberately to titillate and, you know, perhaps to sort of, you know, sexually charge audiences in order that they might pay more money. So what were the motivations of these filmmakers, people started to ask? You know, what is the impact of these films? Are these sacred because their subject matter is taken from the Bible? Or are they profane because what they're focusing on are these sort of sexual relationships and the kind of the excuse to put a pretty woman, I think it's Hedy Lamarr, isn't it, into a kind of low-cut top and a tight skirt. And so this ambivalence with regard to the explicit or the implicit religious intent, content and impact of film absolutely pervades. It just, you know, it drenches the whole history from this point until our point of this relation between faith and particularly Christian faith and film. And the struggle to resolve this tension, to come to some kind of a decision over are these sacred and religious or are they profane, you know, is what a lot of the academic work, certainly, but also a lot of the sort of social and religious work on film has been about. And I think that we can trace four sort of periods of engagement between the Christian faith and film through the 20th century up until our time. And all of them, I think, you can kind of arrange around this question of sacred or secular, you know, sort of positive impact or negative impact. And interestingly, as I've already alluded to, the first period was characterized really by enthusiasm for this new medium and the desire to harness its kind of effective power, the way in which it moved people, perhaps not literally out of their seats to the back of the cinema, but certainly, you know, in their minds and their emotions in every way, to harness that, you know, particularly actually for the Christian gospel. And so at this stage, you know, sort of articles that are written in religious publications or general interest publications are extolling the film's virtues with regard to mission. And it said, you know, its presentational, its effective power was seen to be the great tool for gospel proclamation. And then there was also sort of Christian education, where people thought this is taking the kind of, you know, Jesus's methodology of parables and putting it into, you know, moving pictures. It's incredibly powerful. And if we go to another part of the world, not now Latin America, but Australasia, the first sort of moving picture narrative film ever made in Australia was, again, before the end of the 19th century. And it was made by Herbert Booth, whose parents were the founders of the Salvation Army, William and Catherine Booth. And he saw in film this great potential to impact people. And if you just hit the slide, this is a slide obviously recolored, taken from one of his first films. I think it's The Martyrdom of Stephen, or I wouldn't swear to it. And, you know, in Australia, you know, he started making films and became the most prolific filmmaker for at least a decade there, all following on his sort of parents' intent of bringing the Christian gospel to people. But as I've already said, by the 1920s, this very complicated relation becomes more and more stressed, particularly with the work of Cecil B. DeMille, who we've already seen, his Ten Commandments in 1923, his King of Kings in 1927, was utilizing biblical subject matter, but a film historian, Jack Ellis, describes it as religiosity comes sex and spectacle, and a theologian, Robert Johnston, describes it as a religious gloss over salacious scenes. And so in response to these kind of quasi-religious spectaculars, and in response to the fast-growing, burgeoning sort of genre, we would say, of gangster films, the Christian church began to worry now about this medium. And again, I don't know if I've got any more slides, Steve, on there. No. So the second period of engagement, now we've had our time of the sort of honeymoon period of thinking this is wonderful, the Christian church now starts to think, hang on, you know, we need to put some brakes on this great behemoth of sort of, you know, creative and industrial and sort of market power, and try and sort of restrict the negative impact that it might have upon its audiences. And so it was religious institutions that played probably the key role in the development of the instruments for censoring and classifying film. So in the United States, this very long-standing Hays Production Code, which was actually, you know, sort of had effect from 1930 until 1966, was an attempt at self-legislation. It was put on by the Motion Picture Association of America, but only because particularly the Roman Catholic Church had mobilized a huge grassroots movement which were pushing for something called the National Board of Censorship. And in the UK, sort of clergy and institutes like the Mothers' Union were immensely sort of influential in the setting up of the British Board of Film Censors. And through this period then, we see this kind of adjustment from just, you know, being thrilled at this new tool to worrying about the impact of this medium. And possibly the most important sort of piece of writing, at least, in this period is from Pope Pius XI, of whom I have a picture. So this is Pope Pius XI, and he's actually, if you notice over here, this is a microphone. So this is one of the early broadcasts of Vatican Radio. So he may not look like it, but he was really down with the new technology. He was an early adopter, and he actually wrote a papal encyclical called Vigilante Cura on the motion pictures. And he wrote it specifically to the US Episcopate in 1936, saying to them that it's important that we do everything that we can to serve the needs of the entire Roman Catholic world by seeing to it that bad films that occasion sin and create prejudice and damage the nation's moral fiber be replaced with films directed toward the noble end of promoting the highest ideals and the truest standard of life. And for quite a long period, I think through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, it was this kind of attempt, I think, by the Christian churches to clamp down on what they saw as the excesses of cinema that probably defined that relationship we're talking about tonight between faith and film. But there came a third period, and I think this really began in the 1960s. It began with the rise, I suppose, within filmmaking of the great European auteurs, the men, and it was, I think, basically men, you know, of a particular vision who created films, you know, obviously using a team, but in order to, again, raise some of what they saw as being the pertinent questions that were addressing their society at the time. And so through the 50s and the 60s, we saw, for example, Robert Bresson, who made this film, Diary of a Country Priest, about a young priest in a small parish, country parish, who's actually dying of cancer, and the impact that his ministry and actually his death has on this very small village. Others, Steve, if you hit, let's see who we've got next. Anyone know what this is from? Someone must surely. Josh, do you know? It's Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, and this is death towards the end of the film, leading the sort of central characters on this dance essentially to death. And I put that particular slide up, which isn't one of the most famous sort of images of The Seventh Seal, a death playing chess with a knight whose name currently eludes me. But I put this one up because my supervisor when I wrote my DPhil was a professor of theology at Christchurch, and his Lenten discipline was to have this particular image as his kind of wallpaper on his, all of his computers through Lent to remind him that death comes to get all of us at some stage. That's a little George anecdote for you, Josh. And so another Ingmar Bergman, next one, Steve. Fellini, La Dolce Vita. Don't know if anybody's seen that film. Starts very famously with these images of this huge, you know, almost like Rio de Janeiro statue of Christ being airlifted by a helicopter, and it just sort of goes wobbling and wavering its way across the city of Rome, with no explanation given, no sort of, you know, narrative, you know, importance. But it is the image that begins the film. And then a final one, just to say, Pier Paolo Pasolini's The Gospel According to Matthew. Quite remarkable film, very, very different to any other kind of Jesus film I've ever seen, certainly. Young Spanish actor, interesting film, but very unusual, idiosyncratic, but powerful presentation of the life of Christ. And so while all of this is going on in the sort of film world, as it were, there's a huge change or movement going on within, certainly within academic theology, and trickling down, I guess, for better or for worse, into the churches. And it's the kind of move to a secular theology, a sort of perhaps following the great New Testament sort of scholar Rudolf Bultmann, his demythologizing of the New Testament, that actually moves into people's understanding of the Christian faith. People begin to say, actually, you know, we can translate all that old-fashioned, you know, hocus-pocus, supernatural, you know, Jesus doing miracles stuff into some truths that actually still matter in this kind of secular society today. And some of the theologians who are most associated with that, William Hamilton, co-authored a book called Radical Theology and the Death of God, with someone else called Thomas Altizer. Another author, Harvey Cox, wrote a book called The Secular City. They were all writing at the same time essays in a publication called Celluloid and Symbols, which was about how the Christian church should interact with the world, and particularly with film. And so basically they were taking these kinds of films, the ones with the explicitly Christian and religious subject matter, and those with, you know, just more secular content. And they were engaging and saying, actually, this is the place at which this new kind of secularized Christianity can engage with the wider world by shared discussion, shared revelation, almost shared understanding built around watching these kinds of things. And so this progressed through the 1970s, the 1980s. There were Roman Catholics like John May championing that kind of method that went beyond just looking at the sort of morality of a film and actually looking at the deeper questions that it was engaging with, particularly this idea of humanity being constantly on a quest for ultimate concern, for ultimate meaning, and some of that quest is shown in these films. James Wall was a Protestant author. Lots of discussion about the fact that we shouldn't just worry about the morality, we should look at the bigger picture, the bigger impact that these films are having, the questions that they're addressing. That's where we should be engaging. And I think, you know, this continued, you know, right the way through until the 1990s as the main sort of way of engaging with film. And then in the 1990s, the final sort of period that I'm looking at this evening, there was a huge explosion of academic interest in film, not only in secular sort of philosophy faculties, in the sort of growing cultural studies, social sciences arenas, but also in theology faculties. And we suddenly noticed that this sort of what had been a kind of ad hoc, occasional discussion, you know, between faith and film, began to take on, you know, many of the markers that, you know, sort of that show us that there's a sort of an academic discourse growing up. So suddenly you find that in universities there are specific courses being shown, or being taught rather, on religion and film, or theology and film, or faith and film, as we have here tonight. There are academic publications, you know, journals, peer-reviewed journals springing up around these kinds of questions. And there are conferences going on, particularly I'm looking here at the United States, the UK, and the sort of English-speaking world in Australasia and so on. And I think that in this sort of burgeoning of academic interest in faith and film, there are three particular ways in which the writers at that time, the lecturers, the people who are engaging, are talking about film, or the three particular approaches that they're using. And so one is biblical studies. Biblical studies scholars start to think very seriously about the way in which film both has and is portraying biblical narratives. Sometimes people use films as a kind of hermeneutical tool. They say, you know, this is a way, if we look at this film by looking at what we agree at or with and what we disagree with in its portrayal of this particular biblical narrative, that helps us to understand it. Others are more ideological. They're saying, if we see the way in which, you know, film, you know, addresses, to go back to the one we were looking at earlier, something like Samson and Delilah, we can see how that kind of patriarchal sort of, you know, male oppression is played out in our culture because of the way in which they use this narrative. Second, there are people who are doing something very similar to the 70s. They're theologians, often systematic theologians or philosophical theologians, and they just want to talk about, you know, the kind of issues that film is addressing, what sort of light can theology bring to these questions. And some of them are writing really with a sense that actually film might be religiously powerful in a completely unexpected way. So we've understood that film could be a tool for presenting biblical narratives. It could perhaps be a tool for presenting Christian teaching or truths. These theologians began to say, actually, there could be something about film which makes it a potential locus, a potential place where people can actually encounter God. And so a theologian, I've already mentioned, Johnston, talks about film as a potential place for divine encounter. Another theologian talks about it as a place in which we might be able to catch something of the divine light. And then finally, the third group of people, so you've got the biblical scholars, the theologians, and then you get the sort of cultural studies theorists who began to say, hang on, if we're going to understand film, we can't just treat it as another kind of a text. We've got to understand something about the context in which it's produced, the context in which it's viewed. And so I think, I hope, that this fairly brief sort of overview demonstrates to you this question which runs like a thread, perhaps not a golden thread, but runs like a thread through this faith-film debate, is this question of primarily, do we say that this medium is primarily something which is capable of great good, or do we focus on the fact that it might be capable of great evil? Does it have a morally debasing or a religiously uplifting effect on its audience? And so having looked through some of that, you can just skim through a few slides, actually, I think I've jumped over a couple. So this was just a conference at Harvard actually last year, Representation and Reality in Religion and Film, Imagining the Ineffable. And then if you just keep going, a couple of books which have come out in the last sort of 5 years or so, Introduction, sort of Academic Companions to Faith and Film, or Religion and Film. And I'm just going to spend now about 10 minutes talking about one particular film called Cabra Marcado para Morrer. Is that any Portuguese speakers? I can speak Spanish, I can't speak Portuguese. So that's the Portuguese title. It was made in Brazil. And it's, I think, in all the research that I've done, a completely unique and remarkable piece of cinema. And it's the result of a very, you know, I would think almost serendipitous interplay between unique historical circumstances and one particular director's quite unbelievable persistence. And the director is a Brazilian man called Eduardo Coutinho. And actually, literally this week, in preparing for this talk, I found out that he was actually murdered earlier this month at the age of 80 by his own son, which for me at least, having studied this film and been very interested in it, as a sort of undesired poignancy to the talk. So he was a very old man. He'd made films throughout his career, but he made this quite remarkable one. And the project, which came to be known as Cabra Marcado para Morrer, began in 1962 in Brazil, when this, it would be fair to say, fairly left-wing director was just becoming incensed with the way in which any kind of leader or mobilizer of the kind of the underclasses, the peasant people, whether it be in the countryside or in the cities in Brazil, ended up somehow dead and often beaten up and killed by thugs, but by thugs who were in the pay either of the local landowning elite or of the political elite. And he decided that as a filmmaker, the way in which he could respond to that incredible injustice was by making a film, a kind of biopic, a biography of one of these leaders. And the man that he chose was called João Pedro Teixeira, who was an illiterate peasant, but was the organizer of disenfranchised farmers in northeastern region of Brazil. And his sort of prominence in organizing these farmers for greater rights, for, you know, greater sort of facilities and necessities for their families, led to his being murdered by thugs, basically in that case in the pay of the military. And Cortina began work on this project, and he named it Cabra Marcado para Morrer, which means, I mean, Cabra, yeah, just means guy marked for death, guy marked to die. And, you know, he called it that because he just, because of the inevitability, basically, if you ever raised yourself head and shoulders above the masses in Brazil at the time, you had had it. And Teixeira, this man who was murdered, left behind a wife and 9 children, of whom we have a picture here. So his wife, I think I counted earlier, there are actually 10 children, so you can take a guess as to which one is not his. But this is the family that he left behind when he died. And obviously because of the oppression, because of the fear engendered by the father's death, they, along with lots of the people who were in their movement, fled northern Brazil for a region called Galileia, where the peasants had already sort of established certain rights to the land and to their own harvests and so on. And Coutinho, the film director, followed them to this region called Galileia, and he began to film a biopic of this leader, João Teixeira, using his own wife and his own children and his followers as the lead actors in his film. And he began filming in 1964. In the beginning of the year, he brought a film crew, all his cameras, all of his equipment, and began to film scenes from this biopic. He filmed for about 35 days, and then on the 1st of April, whatever year that was, 1964, there was a military coup in Brazil, and they were forced to stop filming when they suddenly flooded this region that had been somewhat autonomous with troops. And so the director Coutinho, the actors who were all just peasants, the film crew were all forced to flee. And whilst most of the sort of film crew, those who were not from that area, got away, the locals were caught by the military and were tortured until they gave up to the military the place where all of the film equipment had been hidden. And in fact, the military took the sort of the film which had already been shot, and they turned it into a propaganda film, claiming that this director, Eduardo Coutinho, had been making a film to train Marxist guerrillas how to use machine guns and kill Brazilian soldiers. And that, effectively, was the end of the story. It presaged 20 years or more of military dictatorship in Brazil, and this film was effectively lost. Except that in 1982, the director, Eduardo Coutinho, after the military dictatorship had fallen, found that actually the prince that he had filmed had been sent for development in Rio de Janeiro, and without anybody knowing they were there, had been held in a vault in the, in Rio, and he was able to reclaim them. And so he decided to restart work on this film. Obviously, he couldn't make a biopic, but he thought, I'll use the scenes that I already have, and I will trace what has happened to the people who were part of this story that I was trying to tell. You hit the next slide, Steve. And so the film is a mixture of the old black and white sort of recreated scenes from the story of this sort of peasant struggle and interviews with these people who were now spread around Brazil, who had fled the military dictatorship. And so this again is the leader, João Teixeira's wife, being interviewed by Coutinho some 20 years or more after her husband's death and after the attempt to film the story of his life. And so the final form of this film, which there's only one copy in this country, so I can't show you any clips of it. It's in part of the University of London in a library out there. But it's a powerful film that sort of weaves together the, you know, sort of, well, it's not fictional, but the biopic, the narrative, black and white, with these kinds of interviews. And there's a particular scene in it which I think sums up in a remarkable way some of the sort of power of film and some of the interesting questions that surround the way in which people engage with it. And so essentially, there's a scene in this film when the director, Coutinho, goes back to the village where these people, you know, had been, the peasants. And he decides that he's going to show to them the scenes that he'd filmed before the dictatorship came in and, you know, squashed their production. And so you start off with a scene of this dusty Brazilian peasant village, and the camera sort of pans across the village, and you see slightly incongruously these piles of sort of modern film equipment where they've got all of their recording devices, you know, everything, they've got their cameras and everything, and it pans across the village with the sort of mud, you know, effectively mud adobe type huts, and, you know, the few children playing around in the dirt, and you see the sun going down behind the mountains in this sort of purple haze, and it's very beautiful. And then you see that they've set up a screen in the sort of central open area of this village, just made out of sheet and poles, and they have a projector. And gradually the people of that village and from surrounding areas, you've heard this is happening, come and they join and they gather around this projector. And the camera now is just watching this group of people. And suddenly the projector flares into life and the screen goes white before you. And the camera turns around away from the projector and shows these images of these people being projected on the screen. And there's a remarkable transformation that happens in this elderly peasant crowd when they see the film on the screen, because they're seeing younger selves. They're seeing themselves filmed 20 or plus years ago, now played out. And suddenly from being sort of fairly dour and browbeaten and bent and old, you see their faces light up with absolute joy, and you see them gesturing to each other and shouting and laughing and pointing to each other. And the camera goes on for a while, just going back and forth between watching the scenes playing out on this sheet in the village and then back to the audience. And I think that beyond just being actually a very beautiful piece of filmmaking, this is actually itself a very powerful commentary on what film is and the way in which we engage with it. I think, first of all, that this scene highlights the way in which the impact of a film upon its viewer is always affected by the completely unique relationship that exists between each individual viewer and each film. And in this case, it's absolutely obvious because each individual viewer is actually seeing themselves on the cinema. But it's a classic sort of reception theory that actually we all see slightly different films or read slightly different books, even when we have the same thing in front of us, because we bring our own experiences to it. Second, this kind of panning back and forth between the screen and the audience, and the view that we're given of the audience reacting and interacting, I think highlights something which is really only very rarely considered in film studies, and certainly in film theory, which is the communal dimension of film watching. Whether that be just you and your family on the sofa, you and a couple of friends with a pizza, or a huge cinema, or a community viewing something which is of particular value to them. And then thirdly, I think this film obviously makes absolutely clear that films are political, and they have sort of economic relations as well. And so we see that you can't, you know, not take into account those kinds of things when you understand the impact of a film. And then finally, there is this remarkable power which is shown so clearly in this screen, in this scene, where you have, you know, the village filmed in, you know, modern, contemporary colour, and the images on the screen in black and white. And yet it's the images on the screen that compel you and command your attention. And there's clearly something about filmmaking, film projecting, that creates a remarkably powerful kind of hyper-reality, which I think, you know, impacts all of us. I'm going to finish with one quote, which is to say that Cecilia Gomez, a Latina woman who's the co-chair of the Los Angeles Film Festival for a number of years, and in that context, in the introduction to one of the festival brochures, she spoke about an experience from her own life. And when, as she termed it, she encountered God under the stars in Havana, in Cuba. And she says this: "It was black and white on the screen, under a black sky full of white stars. My heart strained at its moorings as the film came alive on a large sheet strung between two pillars. This is indeed a strange tribute, for I don't remember the name of the film, and in my 9-year-old memory only fragments survived. Yet I know that the God alive in the film, whose holy presence stopped the children from desecrating his church, was the same God who danced with us children in that history-paved patio, the God who made me weep." And so she recounts a story as an adult of a 9-year-old watching a film under the stars in Havana, but her memory of it, and again this is secular, this is just a film festival thing, is that she encountered God there. So I said that I would eventually reach where my research began, and so my research was interested with the question of the possibility of revelation through film. Thank you. So that was probably slightly more than the half an hour I promised you, closer to the 40 minutes. But are there any questions on what I said there? And then perhaps if people want to, we can, after one or two questions, watch a film clip or so and talk about it. Are we okay for time?
Yeah.
Yep. So are there any questions on those? Yeah, John.
I just wanted to clarify. So these people here are watching the black and white film.
Yeah.
Taken of them a long time before. Mm-hmm. And then whilst they are watching,
yeah,
is the camera on them and showing their current, in the moment, pictures,
yeah,
on the screen?
No.
No.
So on the screen, it's showing them when they were younger. It's the black and white film that had been recorded 20 plus years ago when they were trying to create this kind of biography of this leader. And then there in color, you know, what we're seeing is 50% them. It's like, just if I'm the camera between the audience and the screen, and the audience and the screen. And so the audience are in color. It's contemporary for the making of the film, 1984, I think it was. And on the screen is the black and white that had been shot 20 years before. Sorry, that wasn't very clear.
I'm intrigued as to how the polarization between those who took a negative and those who took a positive view of film played out. Were there particular portions of church or society that were associated with each position, and were there particular strategies for dealing with the arguments of the other one, or was it all not more amicable?
No, so inevitably, you know, I presented an incredibly broad brush, you know, sort of picture, but essentially, I mean, in the United States, where obviously this was the primary kind of arena in which this was happening, there was obviously a huge difference between, you know, those on the more conservative, you know, end of the Christian traditions and those on the more liberal end. So if we talk about the 60s and 70s, I was talking about how some very, if you like, want for a better word, very liberal, secular, theology type, you know, people were engaging with these auteur films from Europe. They loved them. Simultaneously, more conservative churches, Pentecostal churches, would still have been saying an absolute blanket ban on "you don't go to films, they're evil, full stop. You don't even choose whether there are good ones and bad ones, you just don't do it." So obviously it was vastly more kind of variegated.
And behind the things like the Passion films,
yeah,
were the particular portions of the church that were getting behind that kind of production, or was that nothing to do with...
No, so I mean, I think it was quite entrepreneurial. So, you know, they would say, I mean, Herbert Booth, you know, happened to be the son of the Salvation Army founders, you know, in Australia, but he caught the vision and clearly had the kind of, you know, the business acumen and the creative abilities, and I presume networks of people that could help him and support him and to be able to do that. And I think that was true everywhere. There was no one particular, you know, I don't think there were denominational kind of film collectives. or even Roman Catholic in that sense. It was just, it was individuals and groups putting it on the strip.
Rank, of course, was a leading Methodist.
Yeah, well that, yeah.
Very dominant in the British film.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. So it's very, but you know, it's a very, very good. And there's something quite interesting that I mentioned, literally just mentioned, about the kind of prehistory of cinema. And interestingly, priests, for, you know, just purely, you know, again, serendipitous reasons, had been hugely influential in the sort of the stage before cinema in trying to create, you know, some of the technologies that underlie, you know, this. So it's just, it's a funny story. But there's clearly, there's no, I've given a very much a broad brush account.
Yeah. I think it was the second stage you were referring to. What yeah. was it that you said there was an initial excitement even within kind of like Christian circles?
Yeah.
Kind of
thing. Yeah.
And then it moved to nervousness or yeah. kind of. What would, give me some examples of what, you know, what was it? What caused them to be nervous? What
were it, was two, it was so that the two sort of classic ones. One was gangster movies. Just became the genre. Yeah. That was just what anybody wanted to watch. I've got some other slides which I won't put up from the kind of Hays Code time, where you know, basically at the beginning or the end of a gangster film, you had these quite hysterical kind of disclaimers from the filmmakers saying, "Of course, none of this is intended, you know, to sort of, you know, adversely impact. I'm just showing you something, you know." It's just a, so gangsters was one thing, and then the second one was that people had been thrilled with the use of biblical subject matter, but they suddenly realised, "Well, hang on, this is biblical subject matter, but it's being used."
Yeah.
You know, in a potentially...
Was it truly biblical, for instance, or was it...
Well, I don't think they were concerned about the theology or so much. Oh, it was just that it was, you know, whatever it was, the salacious gloss over, you know, religious things, whatever. It's that kind of thing that people were particularly worried about. And sometimes just because it's a biblical story doesn't mean that you can't turn it into something, you know, that's, you know, looks violent or sexually charged.
Yeah, thanks.
So no other burning questions. Should we try at least one film clip just so that I can film that I, or feel that I promised to use a film clip? So what I'm going to allow you to do, I think, because I'm not just for things of time, is at the beginning I said there were three sort of things that we could look at, and I'll do these in order. So there's a film from 1966 or 67 called Blow Up by an Italian director, Michelangelo Antonioni, and I think that's quite interesting to look at if you want to think about film and philosophy. Has anybody seen Blow Up? Hey, one, thank you. Then, or from one extreme to the other, a film from 1998, I think, called Pleasantville. Surely someone's seen Pleasantville. Few, couple. I think that's quite interesting. I've said sort of faith and ideology. So philosophy was that one, ideology, that one. Another film from 1960s, Cool Hand Luke. Anyone seen that? Paul Newman. A few again. Which I think I put down as faith and theology. So basically, you can either by acclamation or show of hands or something give me an idea of who'd like to look at Cool Hand Luke. Yeah, not bad. For the first one, that's a pretty impressive. Pleasantville. Ooh, that's, yeah, going well. Blow Up. Actually, I'd say Pleasantville has it. It's Reese Witherspoon. Just irresistible. Or is it Tobey Maguire? I don't know. So I'll just give you a quick... We're actually going to look at the trailer of this, which Steve is very kindly going to set up for us. So Pleasantville, I'll give you my kind of take on it before we watch the trailer. And the people who've seen it can disagree with me violently. When I mean, it's a great film. It's not... Pardon?
Courteously,
yeah. Well, courteously. It's a really fun film, very cleverly done, very amusing, well acted. First time I saw it, yeah, I thought that's clever. Second time I saw it, I thought this is the most pernicious piece of propaganda I have ever seen in my entire life. Essentially, you'll see this in the trailer, obviously, I think you'll get most of this. It's the story of a twins, actually. From our contemporary world, so it's set in 1998, west coast of America. Very cool, trendy girl played by Reese Witherspoon, and a very nerdy, you know, kind of, yeah, nerdy brother played by Tobey Maguire. Great line early on in the film where the girl's friends say to her, "You must have come from the cool side of the womb." And basically, the nerdy brother loves this 1950s sitcom called Pleasantville. which is basically small town Americana in black and white, but everything's perfect. Every family is loving, every marriage is rock solid. You know, just it's life, you know, kind of as he thinks, as it should be. And then through some incredibly quirky plot device, the contemporary brother and sister get translated from kind of contemporary West Coast America into the world of this 1950s sitcom. I think Steve's ready for this. Sorry, the volume's not really great. So I do recommend it. It's genuinely quite a fun film. It's quite a clever premise. And as a piece of cinema, of course, it's brilliant because it uses the incredible power of the medium in that transfer from black and white, you know, into colour. So it uses the sort of resources of film wonderfully. And I'll give you my 30 seconds on why I think it's a pernicious piece of sort of ideology and propaganda. Is that the one scene I think you'll have seen in the little trailer there, you might have noticed the girl sort of plucking the apple. You know, the beautiful rosy apple off the black and white tree. There's a number of other sort of points through the story where this kind of Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden scenario is kind of put before you. So one is, again, you may just remember that he went into the kind of soda fountain and he opened the book of art in front of the guy who was running the soda fountain. And as they flick through there, they linger on one of the very famous, I think it's Cranach's Expulsion from Eden, you know, sort of painting. And again, it's one of the first places that colour come into the narrative. And essentially, this film is a very, very deliberate retelling of the myth of the Garden of Eden, you know, of the fall as the coming of freedom to humanity. So it's a brilliantly done sort of piece of propaganda for what I would say is the kind of dominant narrative of our age, which is self-determination. Whatever you do, if you choose it for yourself, that's okay, and that's what will bring you light and life and happiness. And so, and what I think is really, so it's clever, I like it, but what I think is unfair is just that they marshal absolutely every piece of kind of weaponry that you can to portray the people who are choosing for themselves and throwing off, you know, the sort of, you know, the bounds of tradition and whatever, to make them look wonderful and make everybody else look horrible. So one of the storylines is actually the mother, the perfect mother from this little family, actually decides that she's never been happy married to her husband, and so she leaves him, and has an affair with the guy who runs the soda fountain, who actually she's always loved. But the way in which that is portrayed is that the husband, of course, is portrayed, you know, as horrendously chauvinistic and nasty and mean. And she's basically, you know, portrayed as being lovely and wonderful, and she goes off and she has this affair. And they don't, you know, trace any of the impact of that. They just show it's wonderful, she's now free, and that's why she's, you know, coming into colour. And she says, I don't want to go back. And similarly, you saw at one stage a sort of bench being thrown through a window. You know, the people who are resisting this change, there's, you know, a few scenes which are absolutely the classic Kristallnacht, you know, with the Nazis, you know, in the Jewish ghettos, you know, everything being smashed. And again, it's just showing that these people, they're just the forces of evil trying to stop, you know, this freedom with people choosing for themselves. And obviously you realise that the contemporary brother and sister, the Reese Witherspoon, Tobey Maguire characters, are the Adam and Eve who've come back into this supposedly perfect world, but a world where people don't have freedom. And by, you know, their self-determination, by making choices that nobody else can make, they bring freedom and they bring colour to this place. It's a nice story, but it just reinforces that, you know, I would say a myth that basically all you have to do to be happy is be true to yourself and everything will be all right. And anything which you see as being imposed upon you in any kind of authoritarian way or traditional way is only going to sort of grind you down and leave you without any hope. That's my take on Pleasantville. Anyone who's seen it disagree with me? You're very welcome.
Yeah, I would totally agree.
Good. Chad?
I haven't seen it, but I had a question, which was at the beginning, Tobey Maguire's character is fascinated with the 1950s set.
Yeah.
Is that fascination always portrayed the same way, which is sort of neurotic or pathological? Or
kind of. So obviously, yeah. You know, they come from this, you know, their mother... You know, he's going to sit down and he's going to watch a Pleasantville marathon. That's what he's going to do with his weekend. And the reason that he's going to watch episode of Pleasantville after episode of Pleasantville after episode of Pleasantville is because his mother, you know, so that he's from a broken family, and his mother has left for the time being to go off and try and strike up a relationship with some man somewhere. And so he lives this chaotic, you know, late 20th century life with, you know, a broken family and his mother trying to hold down a job and find another partner and this sister who's, you know, sort of a wild child, basically. And he looks at that screen at this perfect family and thinks, that's what I want. I want this mother making me, you know, pancakes every morning and dad coming home at 5:30. And so at that stage it's portrayed positively, and you certainly, you know, he's still portrayed as a nerd, but you can certainly understand what he sees in that. But then when they get there, what's emphasised is the kind of lack of freedom. That yes, everything's perfect, but it's because nobody dare break a rule. You know, everybody just does what you're supposed to do. And they arrive and they change that. And of course, it's very, very common in our, you know, culture. So sort of Philip Pullman's trilogy of novels, his Dark Materials, is, you know, is another deliberate, you know, retelling, you know, of sort of Paradise Lost as Paradise Gained. You know, what that basically Adam and Eve are the heroes of the story because they rebelled against this oppressive, you know, tradition. So it's not by any means the only thing which does it, but it does it in a very powerful way. And first time you watch it, certainly if you're as naive as I am, you walk away just thinking, oh, that's a great story. I think I agree with everything in it. It's a nice kind of parable of, you know, freedom coming into a bound up place. And then you realise, well, what brings the freedom? Is just all it says is you should just choose whatever you think is going to make you happy. And I think that's a less healthy kind of message to be.
It's not a reflection, though, of today's society.
Well, it is, yeah. And so, you know, I suppose it's right the way back to the beginning. I think that this is the kind of area, you know, where we may find the opportunity as the Christian community to push back against this. And to say that, you know, it's a great film, I don't have anything against it as a film, but I don't think, you know, I have a 13-year-old son, I don't really think that what the message that he needs to have reinforced to him is, if you just do whatever you think is going to make you happy, that's the best path for you, that's what will bring you freedom and colour, rather than black and white. Yeah, I was going to digress on a piece of research I read recently, but... kind of time, I think.
It's 8:35.
I mean, I'm happy to keep going.
Can I ask a broader question?
Yeah.
Do you think that particular films have a big enough impact that you could say of any individual film that it actually shifts public awareness, perception, or do you think it's the mass effect of the film industry as a whole? And of course, it's not.
Yeah.
It's multidimensional, a lot of kinds of
things. Yeah, so I mean, it'd be interesting to think of examples, but I don't suppose that any one film can shift public consciousness on its own. But I think, you know, the industry, if you like, certainly can and does. But as I said just at the end of the sort of first piece, for me, my research was actually, I think that the thing which is missed in most kind of theology in film is this kind of the fact that it's a very personal interaction between each viewer and each film. And so my research was into, essentially, boiled absolutely down, I asked people, you know, looking back on your life, is there one outstanding example when you would say a film changed your life? And quite a lot of people answer yes to that. And then, you know, I did a series of interviews and surveys and all the blah, blah stuff. But what was interesting is that, generally speaking, when people could look back on their lives and say just one unique, so I mean, everyone can say a film's changed my life because it's changed my thinking, or it, you know, made me think about something I'd not seen before or whatever. But people who would look back and say, in the 40 years or the 60 years or the 20 years or the, you know, how many in my life, I can just immediately, as soon as you ask me that question, there's one film, one that jumps out. In most of those sort of, you know, extreme cases, actually what was important was not the quality of the film. Was it sort of critically acclaimed? Was it made by one of these great auteurs? Was it, you know, a huge success? What mattered was a particular link between something happening in their lives and something happening in the narrative, or something happening in their lives and a particular, you know, scene or moment, or, you know, it could be quite mystical sometimes. It's not always like a very clear cut, or, you know, my grandmother died and the grandmother died in the film. Sometimes it's just, you know, I was having a really hard time and there was just something about that scene that just connected with me. And so, you know, I think films, you know, change people, but often for very personal reasons, and you can't necessarily extrapolate from those individuals, you know, across a community. So I think that we need to be engaging with films like Pleasantville, you know, both down the pub with our friends and also those who have opportunities in writing and so on, because I think we can resist, you know, the actual intent and narrative and the purpose of the film and ask questions about it. But then, you know, also if we're talking to our friends down the pub about things which have impacted them, we have to be aware that actually it's probably just going to be, you know, something, you know, that just had a particular link at a particular time to them.
Yeah. If people haven't seen the Pasolini film, I saw it years ago, but I remember it was extraordinarily powerful.
The Gospel according to St. Matthew. Yeah, it is extraordinarily powerful. Yeah, and very, very interesting, because certainly the actor, you know, has no faith, and the director was a gay man, a communist, in, you know, very, very negative kind of relationship with the church or any kind of traditional Christianity, and yet produced.
But they did use Mark's gospel pretty well straight.
Matthew's, absolutely.
Matthew's gospel,
yeah, so. Absolutely.
Pretty well straight.
And so wherever, it's a remarkable piece of work, because it's clearly him trying to work something out about Jesus and using, as you say, pretty much the text of Matthew's gospel with no deviations or additions, and creating something very, very powerful. But the church authorities at the time considered it, you know, heretical, basically not so much because of the content as because of who had made it and, you know, where it was going. So.
I'll just say, kind of what struck me, you know, with that Pleasantville film is, you know, is that, you know, what it's doing is kind of crystallising values that are dominant in the society, and things that are assumed but aren't necessarily fully articulated and can be kind of brought together in a film like that. And so I guess, you know, the kind of follow-on thought from that is, you know, certainly the most kind of religiously powerful films I've seen, for example, you know, Of Gods and Men, The Mission, something like that, they kind of grow out of a real living Christian community that existed at one point in history. And then the film can kind of crystallise those values.
Yeah.
And then I guess you're also talking about the kind of the more critical approach the film can have. So we can, you know, try and, you know, lay out what the values are behind a film like that Pleasantville and criticise them. Or I suppose actually in film one could have a more critical approach like that Brazilian film you were speaking about, or other more kind of critical films. So I guess could one make a distinction between Christian films, which portray a social reality that exists of Christianity in a positive way, and then the more kind of critical function, which might be more kind of difficult, I suppose, to achieve.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, so I certainly think that that is one of, you know, I mean, again, it goes almost back to that very first kind of point that I made, that actually there's no doubt there is tremendous, you know, power in this medium if it's used. Well, I mean, there is, and so I think that can certainly be picked up, you know, by the Christian community, or even, you know, often by people who are not Christian, but have simply recognized something in a particular Christian community, or, you know, a particular sort of narrative or biography, and they portray it very, very powerfully, and, you know, that becomes a very powerful witness to Christ and to the Christian community, even though perhaps the people who didn't make it, they're simply responding to something that they've seen. So I think, you know, I mean, clearly would be, you know, the most, if we could go out from here and kind of make a few really good films, that would have vastly more impact, I'm sure, than the sort of critical work of trying to sort of out-narrate, you know, some of the, you know, the Pleasantville type stuff, or to, you know, raise questions about it. But that's a very particular calling, and it'd be wonderful. So I know one, and there are, you know, clearly, it's a challenging thing, but there are, you know, Christian filmmakers out there, obviously, and people who, you know, do make, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, one that I'd recommend, but, you know, good stuff. And that would be
really, well, I guess you mentioned the seventh film. I guess maybe Ingmar Bergman's films, in a sense, they get to the bottom of some of the kind of emptiness of the modern condition or something like that. So in a sense, they're kind of critical of, you know, even though I don't really know particularly what his religious perspective was. I think maybe he came from a religious background, away from it or something. But I guess perhaps he gets into some of the sort of meaninglessness, that sort of thing.
So I think that's the safest thing, you know, that we can say, is that a lot of use these kind of evaluative words, and it's, you have to be a bit careful, but, you know, a lot of what would be thought of as good cinema, I think, is very, very good at raising, you know, the big questions. And, you know, again, to go back to Iñárritu, who is the Mexican director that I started with, the photograph of in his film Babel, and I think that was a sort of trilogy of films. It began with one set in Mexico City called Amores Perros, and then a film called 21 Grams set in the United States, with 21 grams being, you know, the kind of mythically the weight that your body loses when you die, so the weight of the soul. And then that film Babel about, you know, communication and miscommunication. So I think, you know, there are filmmakers who, you know, raise these questions in a really interesting way and suggest some answers. And I think, you know, that's, you know, it's good to be involved in that conversation, you know, agreeing where we can agree and, you know, offering other suggestions as to what the answers might be to these things. I think, you know, there are films, you know, so if I look at my own life, you know, film just because of my age and my interest and everything else, you know, Chariots of Fire, I'm sure lots of you have seen, that had quite a profound impact on me as a sort of 11-year-old. A film which wasn't made as a piece of Christian propaganda at all, but nonetheless had a very powerful and positive presentation of a Christian man, that for me as a sort of Christian child, sort of young man at the time, I found, you know, very, you know, inspiring. So I think, you know, both are out there, but I don't know that we, you know, it'd be wonderful if there were more people doing a good job of making good films, you know, not that they're sort of explicitly confessionally Christian, but just that the actual, you know, that the director is coming with the intent of, you know, either raising questions. Sorry, I'm waffling. Josh?
What do you think about the sort of impact on the audience, of the audience's response on sort of what impact a film has? So, for example, you know, some films we watch to escape our reality, that's never really going to happen, but we sort of enjoy it at a distance.
Yeah.
But other films, you know, maybe we watch in order to fulfil them.
In order to fulfil,
So, you know, we watch a film and then really, maybe if it has such an impact, that we try and carry out what it does. So, for example, with Pleasantville, we might say, well, I'm going to take a choice. Or it might have the opposite effect of saying, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if I had a choice? And I think we seem to have quite different responses of, you know, how do we respond to those two different kind of points as Christians.
So, I mean, again, that's one of the huge sort of discussions in film studies. One of the, again, the sort of possibly the most sort of discussed locus in kind of film studies, whatever, is around violence in film. You know, through all of the sort of periods that I've talked about, violence has always been, you know, one of the kind of presenting features of cinema that people wanted to talk about. And, you know, in that discussion you see exactly the two things that you're talking about discussed endlessly with no resolution. So some people say, you know, if I go and watch a violent film, that's actually cathartic, and I get rid of any kind of need that I might have to commit any violence or anything else, you know, by watching it, and I go out and society is a safer place. You know, other people watch exactly the same films and have exactly the same statistics and social studies and everything else and say, no, you know, people that watch violent films are more violent, you know, in their everyday lives. And I guess, you know, that's a very similar parallel to what we might think of as a film, you know, having either a negative or a positive impact. And again, so the sort of positions that I've come to have been much more that it's difficult to extrapolate these things. It's going to come down to, you know, the individual, what's going on in their lives, who they are, what their makeup is, everything else. It's going to come down, as you say, to the context in which it's watched. You know, if you watch, I think of Stanley Kubrick's Orange, what's it called? Clockwork Orange or something, you know, if you watch that, you know, in an academic context, it's going to make you walk away thinking, you know, violence is terrible, you know, all these are terrible. If you watch it after four pints with your mates, you know, in the living room, and then you're going out onto the streets, I mean, it could make, it's just, I think that kind of, it's hard to extrapolate. So I'm not, you know, I think clearly we need to make a decision about what a good and bad film is, our own decision about what level of violence is appropriate and inappropriate. I'm not saying that there aren't things that we want to rule out or that it doesn't matter. I'm just saying that when it comes to extrapolating to the impact, I think that individual relation to the film and this kind of specific context is very, very important.
I think we've kind of lost that culture. It might have been an immersive experience in the past, but I'd argue that video gaming has sort of replaced cinema as that kind of experience now, at least. Quite curious what the difference is in a first person shooter.
Yeah.
Rather than instinct, but it really depends on, as you said, the individual and the kind of culture you grow up in. Like, I think in America, maybe in Australia as well, you sort of see that as some sort of unreality, but maybe my limited experience in France, you know. So sees cinematographers as like a cultural curators, sort of the more at ease with discussing and critiquing your own society through film and your experience in that.
Yeah.
And as churches, I'm keen to see your experience in Latin America. How do Christians use film in that context? Because I come from the Bible Belt in Melbourne, where, you know, mega churches buy out cinemas on Sundays so that family value films can be shown to the general public, but
Yeah, so I certainly don't have any experience, you know, like that. The places that I engage with film in Latin America, both, you know, in my sort of life when I lived out there and then in the research, were actually around sort of secular film clubs, where, you know, the vast majority of people, just because of a particular demographic, the group we were working with, were atheists, secular. And so my particular interests are in films that don't have, you know, specifically religious or Christian content, but have an impact on people, and trying to explore, you know, why that is and how we can talk theologically about it. But it's tricky. I don't know whether I'd, you know, be keen on the idea of, you know, buying out some, you know, multiplexes and just showing what we think are a particular kind of film that might have the right sort of message or impact, because again, I think that can turn as many people off. And actually, you know, a lot of films, you know, I mean, yeah, in, you know, two of the three of us, glad we went for Pleasantville, two of the other, you know, the Cool Hand Luke and the Blow Up are both, I think, very good films, very interesting, raise a lot of questions, they're doing some very deliberate things with theology and religion and so on, but there are scenes in them that I wouldn't want to be responsible for showing, you know, in this kind of a setting. So, you know, it's a really difficult thing. And yet, for people who are outside of the faith, I think those films are much more likely to start them on a journey of questioning or of discovery than a lot of kind of family-friendly films, you know, where actually the answers are kind of pat answers that people, you know, they might like. It might make you walk out of the cinema with a smile on your face, but actually somewhere in the back of your mind, you know, that doesn't actually map onto my rather messy life.
Dystopian films get much more
useful way.
Well, they can be, yeah, exactly, which highlights some of the problems in culture and society.
Can we look at blow up?
Sorry, Jen.
Can we do blow up?
I don't know, I'm low.
People need,
now,
people need to leave, they can leave.
Okay. Well, there was another question anyway before we...
Well, I'm wondering in your research, thinking about finding the revelatory in film, especially as you mentioned, you know, some of these autorial directors from the 50s and 60s. I mean, the point of the auteurs was to make the film maybe more about the author and less about the illusion of the cinema. Mm-hmm. And so is it possible to find a revelation in actually thinking about the process of an author? And I'm thinking, like, going around to film festivals, I'm the most cited filmmaker by far by other filmmakers, regardless of their solution, is Robert Bresson, mm-hmm. who, of course, is coming from a very overtly Calvinist kind of approach that has, at least in the process, in the form of making these films, is quite opposite of this pleasant little thing. It's a denial, it's a very austere kind of approach to making films where he denies himself these easy pleasures. And so it almost seems that there's room to find revelation in that kind of practice.
Yeah. Yes. So in that actually fits in exactly with my research, you know, ended up with saying that actually I was mostly working with people who were part of a film club. And actually the most revelatory and powerful and life-changing aspects of their film watching, when it, you know, when you go through all the process of talking to them about it, was not the kind of one-off, I saw this film, you know, on this day and it changed me, but actually just the process of being part of that community of watching films and thinking about what they're about and so on is what has the much, the greater impact. And again, I think that's something which is almost completely missed in a lot of, certainly the theology in film kind of work. I think it's much more recognised in cultural studies, film studies, and possibly philosophy and film. But yeah, that kind of the life practice of film watching and the engagement, you know, then becomes much more potent, I think, than just being at the multiplex on a Friday night and, you know, watching a movie and walking out. So yeah. And also, in, so with Bresson, there was with Martin Scorsese, you know, he's collaborated a lot of times, particularly his early work with a writer called Paul Schrader, who again comes from a very strong sort of Calvinist background, and so films like Mean Streets in particular, you know, have very, you know, powerful, deliberate religious taxi driver, religious imagery and so on. But I think you would be much more impacted by it if you knew, if you'd taken the time to understand something of what was going on and what was being intended in the film than just by seeing it.
Following up on that, I actually wanted to ask you a question about Scorsese, and then fortunately you mentioned it yourself. Because, you know, seeing several of his films, I never actually, well, when I was younger, I never actually noticed many of the Christian issues until I read an interview with him where he actually says that, you know, a lot of his work is very much influenced by his Catholic Italian background. But, you know, related to what you said before, I think there is a great potential there for people, and there are lots of people who see his films, films by other very famous directors today, for basically evangelization, because people know that, they see that, and you can use it to transmit a message, but I don't really see priests and missionaries using that very much as they could.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say. Yeah, it's a struggle. So on one hand, I think we feel it's unfair to kind of instrumentalize, you know, someone else's art effectively. I think that's something I, you know, you can feel a bit nervous of, you know, telling, you know, what this film is about or, you know, whatever. And then I do think that there are real, you know, this tension that I've talked about all the way through, is this a positive impact or a negative impact? So, you know, Mean Streets or Taxi Driver, early Scorsese, very powerful films, very violent, you know, almost nihilistic in some sort of, you know, aspects. But, you know, Mean Streets probably more so than Taxi Driver, but an incredibly clear kind of gospel message that ends up with, you know, the guy, you know, bleeding and being, you know, washed in the water, and all, you know, because he's basically carried the cross of this, you know, it's... But actually, you know, I was for many years a sort of youth minister. You know, in that context, there's no way I'd say, you know, go and watch Mean Streets. Working with postgraduate students at Oxford, I'd probably be slightly more open to, you know, people doing it. But I think that's also the difficulty, is that often the films, you know, which are most interesting, you know, fall on the wrong side, at least in certain parts of them, and that kind of, you know, again, to come back, you know, sort of salacious gloss over religious scenes or whatever it is, you know, it's difficult. And I think that's why we can't, you know, use it as easily as we would wish to. Yeah, Chad.
Yeah, what do you make of the Jesus film that's been shown hundreds of millions of times?
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. So do you know that? I mean, people heard of that. It's by far the most watched film by, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of times more than any other film in history. It's a Jesus film. Yeah, so it's Campus Crusade for Christ. It's used hugely in the sort of subcontinent, you know, India. We took a group of international postgrads away a few years ago for a weekend, you know, not Christians, from all different kind of faith backgrounds and secular backgrounds. We showed them Atonement one night, and if any of you have seen that or read the book, the Ian McEwan novel made into a film with, James McAvoy, Kieran Knightley. You know, powerful film about guilt and, you know, those kinds of things. And then the next night we showed them the Jesus film. And it was interesting. So what the Jesus film gave you in that context, with relatively kind of savvy, you know, sort of aware, you know, media or aware, you know, Oxford postgraduates from around the world, is they didn't buy it. You know, it seemed horrible to them as a piece of filmmaking. But at the very least, it's opening up the story of Jesus' life and, you know, giving you some hooks to have conversations about. Atonement, you know, they loved, and, you know, we had some interesting discussions. But which one kind of took you further in a kind of conversation about Christian faith, you know, with Oxford University postgraduates, would be hard to judge. But clearly, in the where it's shown, you know, in very, very rural communities around the world, it obviously has an immense impact. And again, I think it comes back to that, you know, context that we were saying. You know, when you gather your village together, this is something new that's never been seen before. Perhaps you've never had cinema here, you know, whatever. And you show this film, you know, about the life of this man, you know, to people who are less sort of media savvy than Oxford postgraduates. And clearly, it has a remarkable impact.
Yeah, the Jesus films had a big impact in Nepal. And they've got it with, you know, not just Nepali, the kind of national language. They've done it with lots of the small languages as well.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
A really big operation for translation, and it's had a really big impact.
Yeah. So it's still, I mean, an amazing tool, and there's no doubt about it. And again, it goes back to the very beginning of this kind of history, that there are still people using film in a very powerful way. But it has to be in the right context with the right kind of audiences, I think.
Yeah, when I saw it shown in Kenya, you know, I was with a missions group, and it was a really unique experience in community film viewing, because the sound wasn't working. It comes like packaged up, right, with reel to reel, you know, projector, and we could get that part done. But by that time, it had been like two hours from the starting time. We couldn't get the audio to work. And so our local pastor narrated the entire movie.
Wow.
Yeah. And he knew the people, and he had really had them going.
So actually, that can add to the experience. It becomes unique.
Yeah.
Never to be repeated. Deborah.
I have two questions. One is, you mentioned that you're very is there any interesting work around materialism? And how that leads to some kind of religious experience, you know, thinking about what is that, you know, film that you're watching, is it light or shadow, ephemeral time, presence, what kind of thing is that that's being watched, and how do we enter it? But also, that's one. And the other is, I wondered, and this may be slightly unfairly broad, but I wondered how one might locate those kind of early religious film that you talked about, say something like the Ten Commandments as well, which is very spectacular, how we might see that within, say, the history of art, perhaps, and the ability to portray some kind of real presence of the divine. So, if you look back, maybe at art, and I'm really not an art historian, but just thinking, I mean, where do we actually have that before? Maybe, you know, medieval art with all that guilt, work, kind of bringing something really beyond our world to the viewer, but really when you go forward, then there's Baroque, and that's really very human, even though it's quite religious and, you know, that's still very human. And then I'm just trying to trace that further, and is this the next opportunity almost where you have something that where such kind of portrayal is possible, and therefore taking advantage of a lot as well? I wondered how that fits in.
Yeah, so both of those things are very much discussed, you know, by certain people in literature whose names I can't remember at this time of night. But certainly, what is it, so film is, it is unusual, it's a very immersive kind of medium in the sense that obviously it's sound and it's movement and it's colour and it's narrative over time. So clearly there's something unique about the way in which that impacts on people. And people have certainly looked at, the difference between, there's a very famous director from the sort of French New Wave and commentator André Bazin. Has a couple of very nice articles on the difference between, a painting, and a frame around a painting, and the projection of a film on a screen. And he makes a very big thing on the fact that, sort of paintings are, the scientists, I get this right, centrifugal into the middle, right? So it's, paintings suck you in, and the frame, pulls you into the middle of it. In a film, you always know, whether you consciously think it or not, that when, your film sort of ends here, the real world continues on around you. And if you do a 360-degree pan, you continue around, you see much more of the kind of the scene or whatever it is, or the background if it's filmed outside. And you keep going around, and you're going to see the filmmakers and the camera. And so he's very big on this something, about film, which is centripetal, which throws you out, throws your thoughts out into the world in a way in which painting, kind of is more introspective.
I think there should be the other way around.
Did I get, yeah, well, that's what I was trying to, that's why I wanted someone like you, Paul, to help me out. Is it, so centrifugal throws you out, the centripetal sucks you in. Yeah, thank you. That's what I was trying to get. And then some people have argued that the most religiously powerful films are epitomised by someone like Bresson, which is very, if you like, very, very minimalist, the kind of, in terms of architecture and art, generally the kind of classical style, minimalist, and that's what's most religiously powerful. And other people, argue that it's exactly something more like the Baroque, the bigger the spectacle it is, the more impact it has on you. And in film, those two things have been traced right from the very, very first years. I showed you the realist Lumière brothers, and many of you will have seen, Georges Méliès was the other sort of great early filmmaker who made things like, Man to the Moon, which were these impossible sort of science fiction spectacles where you see the moon, the man in the moon with this rocket stuck into his eye. So in film, it's always been, some people saying the power of the medium is its similarity to life, and some people saying no, its power, is in its ability to do things which are just impossible, and that plays out in terms of its religious impact as well.
I think that's all we have time for formally, but we can definitely continue conversations after we've wrapped up. So please do feel free to hang around and chat, and there are some nibbles and things on the back table back there if you want to help yourself to those. Let's give Jonathan another...
So I think kind of for the reasons, I think it's a really interesting place for conversations, necessarily advantages, but it's just discussions with people. And so I think I was always interested, because I found, both as a youth, years and years ago, and then in other contexts, actually, if you're going to have a conversation with someone about big issues, actually films are really a place to start. It's so, few people really these days read about So primarily, I think that's the reason. Just, the eye test.
And
I
don't know. We're still getting back to the
comments. Did you consider about the movie club, the page that
We really should do it. We've done it in the same way. And I've come to the right. chatting race of doing that. It's a movie cast.
Yeah, we do, yeah. Yeah, anyone can play.
So the difficulty is slightly increased. I guess it's okay next week at the more than college, if they start showing a film relationship, I'm definitely not going to be able to clash the discussion after a film. So I think that's what we struggle with, just to make time.
Are you looking for a film club?
I'm interested in more than
My wife and I do that every other week, so you're welcome to bring anyone that can help yourself. It's north up on Banbury Road. It's called the Northern Entrepreneur Student Center. It's student overseas students.
Okay.
It's mostly people who are bailing me out with essential all of the people out there. Because you need something else. Such a people is going to be
such a people, you sort of reaction. You feel like I'm one of those rides. Something the reaction wasn't just keeping you providing acceleration. Such a people is putting all the feel.
Really, very
That's where I lose.
It's one of those ones that's really obvious until you start to think about it. When you start thinking about it, that's when I knew I had hang on, I got this wrong.
I had a question, but I didn't think it was good enough to ask for everybody else. I've sort of noticed, I don't tend to go to any movies, but I noticed the big advertisers on the area or whatever, that there seems to be an increasing number of apocalyptic type movies. I'm wondering, do you think that it could just be a part of the result of that special type of thing?
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a reason why that's happening? Why is that happening now? Similarly, the apocalyptic and the spectrum of it being done in a way that was quite before. So I think there might be some social forces that are back here. They've got the resources to do that. I think there wouldn't be apocalyptic if you still involved the same sort of more inspiring kind of effect, because it seems to be that a good sort of last few years, like, there's three trailers in a row.
And I suppose there is the kind of the global warming stuff again that's quite out of our conversations is that actually, again, we don't necessarily assume it's not as important as the future. But then when I was young, you can remember 20 years or so ago, when I was back in the 80s, it was all nuclear. We were going to not make it for the next decade, and we were going to blow it all up. But there are always these things. I think maybe at the moment we're going through a surge, but I think it's always been popular. Kind of topic for these things.
You can put humor in extreme situations.